Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here at Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It's February 4th. We start with reaction to the headlines at a public corruption case against a former top city lawyer, former police commissioner, and city managing director may finally be over. We get the latest that came out of a status conference held yesterday. And members of the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative say their hopes for another meeting this week with the EPA and the Navy are dashed. No meeting, but for a different reason this time. How the federal DEI funding freeze impacts Hawaii, why it's about more than race. Are we too hung up on the D for diversity? And should we be looking at equity and inclusion? Plus, we take a look at the latest in rat lungworm research into snails and slugs. They are what they eat. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The headlines that two former city officials are to plead guilty to conspiracy charges tied to a $250,000 payout to former police chief Lui Ke Aloha in a public corruption probe is a startling development. The former corporation counsel Donna Leong and former police commissioner Max Sword are to appear in court on March 4th to enter a plea to the misdemeanor charge and pay a fine of $100,000 each. Former city managing director Keith Amamiya has cut a separate deal with the Justice Department. This morning, we talked to retired federal public defender Al Silbert about this unexpected outcome.
I actually thought that there was room for plea negotiations leading up to this trial, because if you looked at the case as laid out in the indictment, it was a very iffy case for both parties. It seemed to me that the government stood a chance to lose, but the defendants also equally stood a chance to lose and be convicted of felonies. So given that both sides had an interest in resolving the case and both sides felt that they could win or lose the case, I think a resolution was the practical outcome. You know, going into a federal trial, normally the prosecution evidence is so overwhelming that a defendant has little choice and very little negotiation ability. But in this case, I didn't feel the evidence was that strong to the point where the government could be so confident that it was going to gain a conviction. So in the end, I actually think this is a very good resolution for all parties.
Well, you do have what will be a conviction when these defendants appear in court on the 4th. But we did see that the prosecutor from California did retire in December.
Right. And I'm sure that played a part of it. Mr. Wheat, who was really the driving force behind everything since 2015, retired in December. And I think because of that, plus with the new administration in Washington, who has a different focus and emphasis on what kind of cases they want to prosecute. They want to also have all their resources in place. So these are San Diego prosecutors are spending time out of their office in Hawaii. When you put all that together, I think there was a strong motivation on all parties to resolve this case short of a trial.
Well, you know, this is a big deal, you know, in the prosecutions that we've seen on public corruption with the police chief and his wife, a deputy prosecutor, Ke Aloha. Lui Ke Aloha, you know, you were involved in that case for your defendant, Gerald Puana. And so those were the first convictions that we saw. And, you know, then we had the Kaneshiro case, and, you know, those charges were thrown out by the jury.
Right. And so if you want to kind of look at the span of time and what's happened since the Puana case and the Ke Aloha case and over the years and all these prosecutions, you know, you can look at it and say, well, it's a mixed result. He got the Ke Aloha's convicted and some police officers, but he lost the Mitsunaga Kaneshiro case. And then the prosecution gets misdemeanor convictions, at least two here. But I don't see it kind of as a negative. I think it's been a very positive event over the last 7 years or 8 years. Because, you know, this really sent a strong message to public officials that corruption will be investigated and prosecuted. And you can't forget all the other prosecutions that kind of played out after this. We had the permitting inspectors who were prosecuted, the liquor commission people who were prosecuted. You had the senator and the House rep who were prosecuted. There were a lot of spinoff prosecutions that kind of came out of this whole investigation that started in 2015. And then, of course, you had the creation of the Foley Commission, the new ethics rules and stronger state criminal laws passed as a result of that commission's recommendations. So if you look at the totality of what has happened, I think it's been very positive. It's kind of sad that it's coming to an end a little bit, but we now have to rely on our local U.S. Attorney's Office, and we have to rely on our state prosecutor and AG office to kind of continue the battle.
Yes, and I believe they have yet to name a U.S. attorney, you know, under the new administration.
That's correct. And, you know, unfortunately, what did happen, and this happened right during the Conashiro trial, which is kind of explains the verdict, is that the United States Supreme Court decided a case that affects all of these types of bribery prosecutions that basically, to some extent, gutted the federal government's ability to prosecute bribery cases. In that case decided literally right before the Conashiro case went to trial, and it affected the jury instructions. The Supreme Court basically said, while the federal government will go after a bribe, it will not go after gratuities. And what that really means is if a politician receives campaign contributions or gifts after an event, even kind of like thanking them for doing something on behalf of a contractor or somebody, that's a gratuity that is not prosecuted under federal bribery statute. So basically, the Supreme Court has said for all of those types of cases, which is kind of a little bit of what the Mitsunaga Kaneshiro case was, those have to be prosecuted by the state under state law. So really, we are in a situation now where I don't think we're going to see another Mr. Wheat coming to Hawaii to prosecute these types of cases. It really falls upon our state prosecutor's offices to do these kinds of charges. And so far, they have not been up to the task.
Well, and there are still some ongoing investigations, and we have yet to see what will come of it with the Mitsunaga Kaneshiro case, you know, with the city prosecutor and a donor. So, yeah, I guess we just need to keep asking questions.
Right. We heard, you know, that there was allegedly threats made against the judge in that case and the prosecutor. We haven't heard anything about that ever since. There was also allegedly an attempt to tamper with the witness. We haven't heard anything about that ever since the news broke. And it's been a while. I'm kind of surprised, given the length of time that those investigations have been ongoing, that something hasn't come out of it. So I'm curious to see if there will ever be charges brought. And if there aren't charges, I think there needs to be some sort of explanation.
And then help us understand what's happening with a former managing director, Roy Amamiya, because he is not pleading guilty as Donna Leong and Max Sword are.
So people may be familiar with the concept of deferred acceptance of guilt, which under Hawaii state law is allowed. And that basically is where someone admits their guilt. The judge does not enter a guilty finding, puts somebody on probation, and if they do fine during that period of time, their case will be dismissed and there won't be a conviction. That's allowed under state law. But under federal law, we don't have an equivalent. There's no such thing as a deferred acceptance of guilt under federal law. So instead, in very rare cases, what happens when the parties agree and the judge agrees, a person can go into court, admit factually that they did a crime, but the judge doesn't accept the guilty plea, holds it essentially in their back pocket, puts them on supervised release. In this case, it'll be for 2 years. And if Mr. Amamiya does all he's supposed to do, pays the $50,000 that he agreed to pay and doesn't commit any further crimes and complies with all the terms of supervision, in 2 years, the prosecutor will come in and simply dismiss the charge.
Amamiya must still pay a $50,000 fine. And then Max Sword and Donna Leong, I think, are up for $100,000.
That's correct. And if you add it all together, it equals $250,000, which is the exact amount of money that Mr. Kealoha was paid, allegedly, in order to retire.
And then do we know yet about, you know, what this plea deal might mean for Donald Young's ability to practice law, since she was the city's top lawyer?
We don't exactly know what's going to happen. You know, sometimes in a plea agreement, a defendant who's a lawyer agrees to give up their law license. My understanding is that's not part of this agreement. So it will really be up to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which is the office that oversees the conduct of lawyers in the state of Hawaii, to decide what action, if any, to take against her.
Okay, so we'll just have to see how this plays out over the next month or so.
That's correct. For ODC, it's going to take a lot longer because they have to have notice and a hearing, so that could take a lot more time.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ali Silbert. Appreciate your time this morning.
You're welcome.
That was Ali Silbert, retired federal public defender, talking to us about the latest development in the city public corruption case against a former Honolulu Corporation Council, Donald Young, Police Commissioner Chair Max Sword, and City Managing Director Roy Almamia. We did reach out to former Mayor Kirk Caldwell for a comment yesterday. We got a statement from the mayor through Attorney Lex Smith, which read, "I do not know the specifics. However, I am pleased that the government dropped the more serious felony charges. While I do understand there are reasons parties enter a plea agreement, I always felt they were innocent of all charges and would have been vindicated if they went to trial. Roy Almamia, Donald Young, and Max Sword, to my knowledge, performed their duties to the city in an ethical, responsible, and legal way. And I think this plea agreement confirms that. This is the last chapter of the Kealoha scandal that haunted the city, and I am glad it's over," end quote. And we'll have more on this case coming up right after a short break.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation. Today we're talking about the plea deals with former City Corporation Counsel Donald Young and the former Honolulu Police Commission Chair Max Sword and Managing Director Roy Almamia. Joining us now is Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Christina Jedra, who has covered many of these public corruption cases. Good morning, Christina.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you have spent, oh my gosh, so much time pouring through court documents. And you also reached out to the mayor yesterday.
I did, yes. I left a message for him, did not hear back, but his attorney reached out with a statement, as you read just now. And, you know, there are the things that he says and the things that he doesn't say in his statement. Former Mayor Kirk Caldwell has never really explained his involvement in this Kealoha debacle. You know, it's worth noting that he appointed all three of these people that resolved their cases yesterday regarding the payment to Louis Kealoha. And, you know, the people have always asked the question, well, what did Kirk Caldwell know about this? Did he direct his subordinates to make this payment? Did he know that they would try to circumvent the city council? Did he tell them to go about it that way? I mean, all these years later, we still don't know the answers to those questions. You know, I've asked them a couple times over the years, and I think my colleagues have, and I'm sure other media have as well, directed those questions to Kirk Caldwell, and they've gone unanswered.
We do know, though, that the former interim police chief, Kerry Okamoto, balked at having that money, the settlement money, come out of the police department's budget, saying, no, this should go before the council because it's a settlement. So he wasn't all keen on stretching the truth there.
That's right. And Cary Okimoto is really key to this case, because when he saw things were happening in a way that he felt uneasy about, he started recording conversations secretly and gave those recordings to the feds. So that probably was one of the strongest pieces of evidence they would have introduced at trial. I guess we'll never know, since the trial's not going to happen, but that's pretty compelling stuff to hear the defendants, you know, having these conversations about, well, we can just, money is fungible, we can just move it from here to there and it's not a big deal. And when Okimoto felt it was a big deal, and I guess the feds agreed with that.
Yeah, I mean, really interesting. And, you know, I know, judging from the comments from readers, they do feel like, that maybe these folks got off too lightly.
You know, I always enjoy reading our Civil Beat comments, and that does seem to be the sentiment from many people this morning reading this news. I think people wanted what they felt would be more accountability for all this. I don't know. I don't know if it's ever satisfying for people once something, once wrongdoing has happened. I don't know that people ever feel that it can be made right. But it looks like if the judge approves this, this is how this one will be resolved. And it's kind of the end of an era. These federal prosecutors have been investigating corruption in Honolulu for about 10 years now. It's been quite a while, and they really covered a lot of ground.
You know, and in your story, you mentioned that Chief Kealoha is due to get out of prison pretty soon.
Next year, yeah, yeah. And Catherine Kealoha still has a while to go. She is set to regain her freedom in July 2029. So she's got another 4.5 years or so. But some of the other folks that assisted them in the famous mailbox case have already served their time and gotten out. So, this is kind of closing this chapter of this case that really consumed so much public attention in recent years.
Yes, and you have covered and tracked the Department of Planning and Permitting scandal as well, the bribery cases there, mm-hmm. and then also the two, you know, state lawmakers, Kalani English and Ty Cullen, and I believe they're out of prison too. So yeah, it's amazing how fast time goes.
Yes, there is lots of stories to keep us busy here at Civil Beat and HPR. We are always tracking these public corruption cases closely. It's so important to hold officials accountable and people in a position of public trust that they take it seriously.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Christina. Appreciate your reporting.
Thank you.
We have been talking to Christina Jedra. You can head to civilbeat.org to read her more stories.
An octopus has more than one brain. They can recognize individuals outside of their own species. They are also eaten by humans around the world. In Spain, a proposed octopus farm claims it could raise 1 million animals a year for food. That's sparking protests and possible bans even here in the United States. Animal intelligence, human sustenance, and the debate over octopus farming. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Triennial 2025. Aloha No is a contemporary art exhibition exploring aloha as acts of care and transformation. Opens February 15th, hawaiicontemporary.org.
The Red Hill Community Representation Initiative was formed in the aftermath of the Red Hill fuel spill, where the fuel ended up in drinking water. The idea was to give voice to the communities with a vested interest in the review of the Red Hill fuel storage facility. But the group has had a rough go of it from the beginning, and its involvement in the process recently took a new contentious turn. This morning we talked to Marty Townsend, chair of the Red Hill CRI and specialist with Earth Justice. She says the Trump administration memo limiting external communications has affected talks over the Red Hill controversy.
I find it disconcerting that the EPA staff are severely limited in their freedom to speak to the public that they are serving, while the U.S. military just put out another invitation to a town hall. So it looks like the Navy folks get to speak freely to the public however they want, but other federal entities, especially regulators, don't have that freedom and flexibility at this stage.
Well, I was a little concerned last week when I was making calls and was hearing about this memo that went out about the external communications and that it was affecting media and the general public. And then even Representative Ed Case had said that his staff was having difficulty. The federal agencies that his office normally interacts with wouldn't even talk to him. So things are changing hour by hour. But, you know, my question was, well, how does this affect the CRI meetings? And so what can you tell us on that front? What do you know?
Well, I mean, we were in the middle of negotiating with the Navy mediator, facilitator going between us. And so we were in the course of scheduling the next CRI meeting with the Navy. You know, they were supposed to meet with us. The Navy was supposed to meet with the public in December, and at the very last minute, they decided not to attend, and for which they got fined. And so we had high expectations for our next get-together, next meeting, which was supposed to be in February with the Navy, but that's off the books. So we're hoping that whatever additional delays have been added to the process for the EPA to work out these details with members of the public, like the CRI. Hopefully it'll be done in time for there to be a meeting in March with the Navy. And I'm expecting that, you know, if we don't have a meeting in March with the Navy, that, you know, the CRI will definitely be pursuing higher fines and violations for the Navy, because we've been going, you know, we're almost to a year now since the public has met directly with the Navy, not in like one of their performances that they are completely in control of, but in a genuine open conversation with the public that hasn't happened for almost a year at this point in terms of the Red Hill fuel tanks.
Was there supposed to be a meeting this week?
We were originally planning for a meeting on February 6th. Logistics didn't come together in time for that. And so we were hoping to maybe find another day that was convenient for everyone, but we didn't get to complete that conversation because this order was issued, and it went from back and forth emails and phone calls with EPA officials to nothing, you know, in the course of a few hours.
So what did the memo say exactly?
I don't have it in front of me, but it basically directed federal agencies to not have external communications, no direct communications to the public without authorization.
So it's definitely stymied things at this point.
Yes. I mean, things are already, in terms of, you know, the Red Hill fuel facility and trying to, you know, rebuild public trust in the process and just to make sure that we were thinking things all the way through, that has been stymied by this Trump order. It was already slowing down and not going nearly as smoothly as it should have been, but now this is just completely blowing the whole thing up. So we at the CRI are waiting patiently for federal agencies to figure out what's what. And in the meantime, we will continue to meet and share information as best we can. You know, we're reading all of these reports that have been put out, and we are trying to, you know, just make those more accessible to the public so that people understand what's happening.
When Representative Ed Case was on our program last week, he expressed some dismay that the inspector general positions were cut. He raised the point that the DOD inspector general came out with a report, you know, that called out the Navy and their lack of responsibility for what happened at Red Hill and the fact that the jet fuel got in the drinking water. What are your concerns about that?
I don't have any direct evidence right now, but I am definitely concerned and on the look for evidence of retaliation against the Office of the Inspector General for issuing such a scathing report. It was very revealing and not flattering to the Navy at all.
And I could see how, you know, this choice by the Trump administration to reduce public communications could be abused to, you know, reprimand those federal regulators who, you know, were trying to do their best to expose problems within our system.
Representative Case is just concerned that without those watchdogs, public interest may not be served.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It is already, before the Trump administration, it was kind of hard to figure out what was going on in the U.S. federal government, and now it's, like, infinitely harder. And I recognize that, you know, some people in the Trump administration or people who support the Trump regime are looking to, you know, make significant changes to the way in which the government operated. And, you know, there's some validity to concerns about how, you know, things have been done in the past that facilitated stuff that wasn't in the public's interest. But I feel like the chaos that has been created by this particular approach to that, it's just more harm after bad, right? Like already Red Hill families have suffered so much, and the lack of information has been sort of foundational to many of the problems that Red Hill families have been facing. And that has just been increased significantly now at this stage, and it's heartbreaking. Our government really should be working on our behalf, right? Working to help us. And these kinds of limitations on, you know, who they can speak to, when and how, just go to further foment the distrust and the schism between the public and the government, right? The government for, you know, the public for which the government is supposed to be serving, and the public itself. So it's crazy.
The fact that, you know, these third party watchdogs within the departments are not there, you know, I'm not real clear on, you know, whether those terminations then mean that no one else will take those slots in those offices, or if it's a total elimination, you know, and if anyone's trying to remedy that.
Things are moving so quickly. People don't really know what's going on. My understanding, it was just the people in those positions that were released, and the positions themselves still exist. But who knows, right? And it's all about priorities in terms of which positions get filled first in the future and with whom, right? So, I mean, part of what we have to acknowledge is that whoever was working in OIG, you know, in the last 2 years did a really good job of thoroughly documenting all that went wrong at Red Hill. And they didn't even cover everything, but they covered a lot. And as a result, they were let go. That does not bode well for the, you know, effort to rebuild public trust in the U.S. government.
So going forward, I guess you just sit tight to see what other communications you get from the EPA?
Yeah, I mean, what are our other options? We have no power in this situation.
And you say that the Navy just put out information about an open house?
Yeah, they have a new open house coming out mid-February, a town hall that they are, you know, focusing around the HICM community. Red Hill will definitely be part of the conversation, but it's one of those situations where, you know, the U.S. Navy gets to control the entire conversation, right? The location, the format, what questions are asked, what questions are answered, they are in control of all of that. And so it's not really, you know, a transparent, open dialogue with the people who are directly affected by the Navy's actions. So while any information is appreciated and valuable, you know, these kinds of military-led town halls don't meet the minimum expectations local people here have of being able to fully engage with the decision makers and understand what's going on. And honestly, just double check and make sure that they do a good job, because they don't have a great track record.
Well, I know that they have started a campaign with podcasts, you know, to try and get more information out in that way. But you would prefer more dialogue.
Yeah, because the one-sided, you know, you only know what we tell you type of information transfer no longer cuts it. Right, because they have been, you know, selectively sharing information for years, and as a result, they haven't had a full picture. Right, how many of our elected officials said after the 2021 leak that if only they had known? Right, because we trusted the military, they didn't tell us the full story, and now we are, you know, we're all caught by surprise. Well, not all of us. Some of us could tell what was going to happen, but many of us were caught by surprise because the Navy wasn't forthcoming from the beginning. And unfortunately, this choice just goes to further this distrust that we can't rely on the U.S. federal government to be there with us and to, you know, help us through this very difficult, challenging time. We're facing another, 30, 50, 100 years worth of effort to clean up our water. Now, the island of Oahu's water supply is at serious risk, and the U.S. federal government isn't a trusted ally in the finding a solution to our problem. That's very troubling.
Well, hopefully this logjam will be broken and you can continue with the dialogue with the federal mediator and negotiator, you know, that you folks are trying to work with.
Yes, I am nothing if not militantly optimistic that at some point we will get it right.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Marty. I appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
That was Marty Townsend of the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative discussing the latest developments in the review of the Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility. We did reach out to the EPA and Navy for clarification on the next CRI meeting. Did not hear back from the Navy. The EPA says it has not set one yet. A Big Island nonprofit is reeling from President Donald Trump's orders to eliminate funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Justin Canellis is the program director for Recycle Hawaii. His organization was nearly a year into an educational program funded by a $1.5 million grant from the Environmental Protection Agency. But last week, he learned of the Trump administration's executive orders to block federal funding for DEI programs. Canellis scrambled to withdraw money for the week's payroll. Since then, his organization's account has been locked. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the impacts of the Trump administration's policy and what he thinks many are getting wrong about DEI.
So unfortunately, yeah, this order has completely suspended our youth-led recycling education outreach program and left us in limbo. Unless our account becomes unfrozen this week or we raise several thousand dollars, we will need to shut down our program and lay off our full-time staff as well as our part-time youth employees. So this has a major impact on us. And there's tons of organizations around the country facing the same situation that we are. Now, the reason that this program is being targeted as a DEI initiative is because our grant was funded in part due to a component of the Inflation Reduction Act centered around environmental justice. And this component's called EJ40, which requires that at least 40% of the program funding in the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, would go towards low-income communities that bear the environmental and social burdens that come with industrialization. The basic idea of this being that if we're going to spend all this money on infrastructure, let's do it in a way that brings the added bonus of lifting people out of poverty and reducing the impacts that lead to massive spending on social services and incarceration, which we see increase when the basic needs of communities are not addressed and lack the economic opportunities to keep their community members out of poverty. So it's this environmental justice component of the funding allocation that's being targeted as DEI, because it accounts for external factors of a community, including average median income, environmental burden, lack of access to resources, poverty level, high school graduation rates. All of these things get taken into consideration along with your application. But even with those factors, you know, you still have to go through an extremely rigorous vetting process and have to submit detailed reports showing how funds are spent and that you're meeting deliverables that are very clear and agreed to in your contract agreement.
What did Recycle Hawaii set out to do? And tell us more about this youth-led program that this grant would have funded.
Yeah, so, you know, this grant, it's a $1.5 million recycling education and outreach grant. It's a three-year grant, and we are in month 10 out of the 3 years. So we're coming up on the end of our first year. So we still have 26 months left to go in our contract. And so this program we developed, which we're, you know, incredibly proud of, and we've seen it really just totally transform these kids in this community. It's called the Hawaii Youth Clean Stream and Waste to Wealth Initiative. And this program is youth-led, which is a really important component because it really empowers this cohort of students in Kau that have very limited opportunities for professional development, especially in this kind of remote part of the Big Island. And it really puts them in the driver's seat with oversight from our Recycle Hawaii staff. So these zero waste advocates are tasked with creating behavioral change campaigns, collection events and waste diversion programs in the Ka'u community that help reduce the amount of waste going into Hawaii County's landfill, which is on pace to fill up and will cost the state's taxpayers about $500 million to site a new one when it does fill up. So it's really important, the work that they're doing, because, you know, along with this, they're creating a model that can be shared with school districts across the state and even across the country. So already they've launched a cafeteria waste diversion program that has diverted over 6,000 pounds of food waste in the first few months. They've also partnered with Hawaii Energy to run a refrigerator and appliance trade-up program here in Ka'u that's been widely successful and is on track to replace over 60 old refrigerators and freezers that are energy hogs with new energy efficient ones at a very reduced cost to the Ka'u community members, which is a huge win for them. And along with these, because we have been busy, they've hosted community collection events where they educate the community on how to reduce waste. They collect bottles and cans for their program, and we also have a cardboard shredder. So they collect cardboard that's bound for the landfill, and they shred it and upcycle it for gardens and farming to replace plastic weed mats, and finding different ways that we can use cardboard to replace plastic products. They've started a company, which is called Malama Aina Compostables, and they're developing zero waste services for events here in the community, as well as waste audits and consulting on how businesses, events, and even in your personal life, how you can reduce waste. And then on top of that, you know, they traveled to New York to present at the National Recycling Congress, and they were the stars of the show. And, you know, they brought the aloha with them, and they really put this concept of, you know, Malama de Aina to the forefront of that Congress and just, you know, made a really profound impact on the attendees, and you could really see it. So for how much we've done in just 10 months, it's pretty incredible. And, you know, we really see this as a small fraction of the federal budget having a really, really high impact, you know, especially in the realm of the waste issues that not only Hawaii is facing, but all across the country and the world.
And I think it's important to draw this distinction when we're talking about DEI and this grant. Nobody is saying that recycling qualifies as diversity, equity, or inclusion. You know, it's the fact that this grant was earmarked specifically for the equity part of DEI. So why is Ka'u in need of a little more equity?
It's been really difficult watching these blatant lies and misconceptions about DEI dominate the conversation and completely drown out the real benefits these programs have for disadvantaged white and minority communities all across the country. And this is a very common misconception because, unfortunately, you know, the racial aspects of DEI, the diversity portion, has been used as a means to discredit these initiatives and plays off of, you know, these undercurrent of racial tensions and divisions that have plagued the U.S. for centuries. But in fact, you know, there are two more words after diversity, equity and inclusion. And the equity inclusion part are used much more in a socioeconomic way. When we look at Hawaii, you know, not only is Hawaii a very diverse state, but we have to ship everything in. When it comes to landfill burden, I mean, you know, we're already seeing what's happening on Kauai. Their landfill is pretty much filled up. And I know Oahu is facing similar issues too. And the equity and inclusion part of this applies much more in how can we include communities that are typically excluded from funding? How can we create a more equitable country, really? I just think it's important to note that predominantly lower and middle class white communities are recipients of DEI funds because their communities are also under-resourced and disadvantaged, like a lot of predominantly diverse and minority communities are. It's really tough to see the misconceptions of this really dominate the space.
What are some of the emotions that you've been feeling over the past week?
It's been a combination of, I would say, anger. You know, it's just been promising a group of high school students a 3-year program, getting 10 months into it, and, you know, empowering them, see them step up and be like, nope, sorry, we're just going to pull this. On that level of just promising youth these opportunities and then just totally pulling that out from under them is, I think, one of the most difficult things that, yeah, really plays off of this frustration. But on a flip side to that is to see our students rally and our community kind of rally behind us and really support us and want to see this keep going. I think that there's a level of hope and you know, you get inspired to I guess, you know, rally to the cause to save something that's really important for the community. So it's been mixed emotions. I mean, our program officer at the EPA, they can't give us any information. So just really the fact of just leaving us completely, not only withdrawing our funding or suspending it, but then completely not giving us any timeline or anything to work with where people's lives are on the line. People's ability to put food on the table are on the line. And it's just a very, I think, callous and, you know, just kind of blatant disregard for the human element behind these programs. And, you know, I think we can do better. And I hope that the administration and the EPA comes to their senses and really does see the value and the humanity behind these programs.
That was Justin Canellis of Recycle Hawaii speaking with HBR's Maddie Bender. His organization has just launched a fundraiser to keep the youth-led recycling program running while the group's federal funding remains frozen and its future uncertain.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend HPR presents Ke Aho. This concert is a part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. Ke Aho is performing this Saturday at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30, here on HPR One.
Heavy rains brought flash floods across the state last week, and in the storm's aftermath, you may have seen something else, snails and slugs slithering about. Hawaii is considered the epicenter of rat lungworm disease, which is spread when people accidentally consume snails and slugs that have eaten infected rat droppings. But certain species of snails are more likely to harbor the parasite, making researchers wonder if those species have a preference for rat feces. Randy Rollins is a PhD ecologist who led new research into this topic. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the work.
I never imagined I would be investigating snail food preferences of the, but that's where the windy road of research takes you sometimes. And it was a very basic but foundational question, I think, that needed to be answered. So what we did is, in my time and my colleagues' time in the field, we've seen snails snacking on different foods while we're out and we're observing them in their natural habitat. And we also did a literature dive to understand what food choices are preferable to different snail species. So we wanted to test rat poop, which is that infectious transmission bridge to the slugs, against other food types that snails may really like. And so what we did is we set up an arena, which is a circular cage, and kind of a fun story about that. Many years ago, I used to work as a wedding cake decorator. I made cakes for people before I decided to become a biologist. And when I made cakes, we would often package them in round circular cake containers. And that's how I came up with the idea of using cake containers as these food choice arenas.
I read cake domes in the study, but I had no idea there'd be a story there. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's where that came from. So that was fun kind of blending my past career with current. So we set up these cake domes, and essentially the setup was we put one individual snail in the center of the cake dome, and we placed four food types in equal distances around the perimeter. So romaine lettuce, a lot of these snails like romaine lettuce. So we included that. We included papaya. A lot of the slugs and snails are munching up the papayas before we can pick them. We used rat feces and hibiscus flowers. I often see snails and slugs eating fallen hibiscus flowers.
So you looked at about 200 snails split up into four different species. Are any of those species the recognizable ones that people may have seen on the street after rainfall?
Yes, they are. And I also should have mentioned our snail species choice was selected based on common species you would encounter, but also their rat lungworm prevalence in the wild. We wanted to get a gradient from very high prevalent species to very low, and then the mid-range. So we used a giant African snail. I think that's probably the most recognizable snail here in Hawaii, perhaps. We also used, after it rains, you might see on your sidewalk, on your grass, a large brown slug that has a white stripe across his back, sometimes little black spots. So that is Veronicella cubensis, the leatherleaf slug. And Veronicella cubensis has very, very low rat lungworm prevalence. Maybe 3% of the individuals that we've tested are infected, as opposed to the giant African snail, anywhere from maybe 30 to 40% are infected. We also tested another big slug, but this is the big black slug. So this big black slug also has a white stripe across its back. It's more common in drier areas, and it looks very similar to the brown slug. But this black slug is Laevacollis altae, and it also has a mid-range prevalence. And then the last species we found is known commonly as the semi-slug. It was first found in Hawaii in 1996. It's a slug, but it almost looks like a thumbnail, like a very yellow thumbnail on its back. We find them in wet, wet areas. So on the windward side, we find pockets of this semi-slug known as Parmarian martensi. We don't find them in very dry areas, but they are a fantastic host for rat lungworm. In some of our studies, we've found maybe about 70 to 80% have been infected with rat lungworm. And in some sites, over 90% of the individual semi-slugs have been infected.
So with those four species, if you're designing this study, you haven't conducted the experiments yet, you might be thinking the ones with a higher prevalence for rat lungworm might be more drawn to rat feces than these three other foods. But what do your results actually show?
Yeah, that was our hypothesis, exactly. And our results showed that in the case of the semi-slug, with very high rat lungworm prevalence, it had a significantly higher preference for rat poop. So almost 12% of its diet was made up of rat poop. So that kind of fit our hypotheses. However, Veronicella cubensis, this is the brown slug that you'll see usually after a rain, it had the second highest preference for rat poop. But at the same time, it has about a 3% rat lungworm prevalence. So that does not match our hypotheses. The other two slugs, the black Laevacollis altae and the giant African snail, they more or less kind of fit their rat lungworm prevalences. So yeah, our results found that in some ways, their preference to eat rat poop, their coprophagic tendencies do match their rat lungworm prevalences, but it's not always the case.
One of the things I was thinking about with this study is because the giant African land snail, these slugs that you find in Oahu after heavy rains, those are all introduced. So are rats. So does that reveal other fields for studying? Like, how much don't we know?
Yeah, you're right on track with that. Invasive species, there is a bevy of research that shows invasive species can, you know, bring along the parasites that they harbor. And sometimes those parasites thrive in that new environment. Other times, the environment isn't so suitable for that parasite. But the question here in Hawaii with rat lungworm is interesting. In fact, a question we have is, when was rat lungworm introduced to Hawaii? And that is another avenue for research that we're kind of starting to delve into.
One thing I was wondering, if so many of these snails that carry or that have the parasites are present on Oahu, why is it that Hawaii Island has the highest number of infections, human infections, of rat lungworm?
That's a very good question. I think that's the million-dollar question. I can say Hilo is very wet. And so these wetter areas, we see more prevalence and typically intensity. So the number of parasites that are within an individual snail is also higher in these wetter areas. And so that can definitely lend to it. A wet environment is conducive to a snail moving around. So maybe there's more room for interaction with people. The semi-slug that we talked about, Parmeri martensi, is very common on that part of the Big Island as well. So there are years, I have friends that live out in Hilo, and they say there are years where that slug is so common that they'll go to class for the day, and when they come out to their car, the slug is climbing over their car. So I think that could lend to it as well. Also, there's an idea that some folks use catchment tanks to collect water, and that may be a transmission pathway to infection as well. When a snail or slug dies in water, or when it dies at all, the parasite will leave the body. And if that snail or slug is in water when it dies, the worms can leave. And they can survive for some number of days in the water. So that could be a contributing factor, but it needs to be studied so that we can know for sure.
And then finally, thinking about things that listeners could take away from this, I thought the information you shared about water catchment was really helpful and really useful for families. But given the results of this study, any takeaways for the general public, in addition to not touching snails? I think that's a pretty clear one.
Yeah, don't touch snails barehanded. If you do, then don't, you know, lick your hands. Don't eat raw snails. If you like to eat snails, go for it. Just make sure they're well cooked. And, you know, usually the question a lot of people ask me is, especially if they're quite nervous about rat lungworm, because it is all over on the island where we've tested, we have found it. But keep in mind, we have such low reported numbers. So I still buy local produce. I go to the farmer's market, I buy my produce. I just wash your veggies really well. Take care with that, but it's safe. Just want to dislodge any snails or slugs that may be on your produce. And keep your dogs safe. That dogs do, we do get quite a few cases of rat lungworm disease in our dogs. And that can happen from them eating snails and slugs, which can be difficult to prevent, but just keep an eye on your dogs.
That was Randy Rollins, an ecologist studying how rat lungworm disease spreads between rodents, snails, and humans. She spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about recent research into what different species of snails and slugs like to eat. We'll have a link to the paper on our website after the show. Well, we have to go now, but tomorrow we plan to talk about Maui's drive to increase solar power. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.